Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another Peak Prosperity podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson, and today we're going to look at the economy with someone who can truly help us see the big picture. His name is Barry Ritholtz, and it would be impossible to list all of his achievements, awards, appearances, let alone convey his impact on the financial world. So I'll just touch on a few highlights here. He's the author of the book Bailout Nation. Lauded is the best reviewed book on the bailouts to date. You really should read it if you want to know how we got here and where we're going. And as well, he's the proprietor of the extremely popular and often praised financial and economic website, The Big Picture, found at ritholtz.com. In his day job, Mr. Ritholtz is CEO and director of equity research at Fusion IQ, an online quantitative research firm. And the firm makes its institutional strength number crunching available to individual traders and investors at an affordable price. I can hardly think of a better person right now to talk about our turbulent financial markets, where they are likely headed next, and where investors may be able to find acceptable returns at acceptable risk. With the ECB, the Fed, the Bank of Japan now announcing massive new liquidity injections into global markets, people need that guidance more than ever. Barry, I'm thrilled to have you as a guest.
Well, thanks for having me.
I always like to begin at the outside, widest possible view if we could, so we share the necessary context maybe to make sense of these details. I'd like to begin, as it were, with the big picture here, take stock of circumstances in which we find ourselves. And I want to begin back in May of 2012 when you wrote a piece entitled Where Sea Monsters Live, in which you recounted a dinner conversation. You observed maybe the conversation was not distinguishing very crisply between debating policy and managing assets. And that perhaps there's quite a lot of armchair policy critiquing going on out there right now, but that people like you, like me, still have to wake up every day, make decisions.
That's exactly right. You know, it's an ongoing debate I've been having with a number of friends who are all traders, hedge fund managers, people running different types of assets. And, you know, if you're not playing football, there's always the tendency to be a Monday morning quarterback and say, this guy should have done this. Why did they go for it on 4th and 2? Yeah, it's a very different philosophy when you're on the gridiron making actual decisions. But what I find kind of astonishing are people who are literally on the gridiron, supposed to be making decisions, and they spend most of their time Monday morning quarterbacking. You know, the whole idea of where sea monsters live, the analogy I sort of went off on a rant at a dinner party one night is, hey, I'm the captain of a sailing vessel, and I have passengers and crew that I have to get safely from here to there, and it's my job to know, what is the wind like? What does the weather look like? The tides? Can I guide the ship by the stars?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and where do the sea monsters live? And what I don't get to do when you're out and there's danger and you have to make a decision, do you make a dash for it or return back to port? What you don't get to do is lean back and criticize the tides. You don't get to, gee, this north wind really is going about it wrong.
Yep.
You have to read the signs, read the sea, read the circumstances, and safely get to where you're going. And I'm finding lots and lots of managers aren't doing that. Instead, you see missive after missive after missive about why the Fed is destroying the world. I've been pretty critical of the Fed over the years, but that's sort of my weekend fun thing. And you know, I criticize Greenspan and Bailout Nation, and I scratch my head over what Bernanke is doing, but that is, you know, it's a footnote. My job is to look out and say, what's the impact on their behavior and their actions on opportunities and risk? How do I navigate those seas knowing that the Fed is a player in the entire situation?
And so then you followed up this excellent piece back in May and September with another one entitled Situational Awareness, drawing on a military metaphor. And in that one, you wrote that These days, you know, the FOMC is they're a participant. They're in the market. And so the line I liked you had was critique the Fed, but manage your assets. Do you see that the Fed, like the FOMC, they are a full-on market participant at this point. Is that right?
No doubt. I mean, and it's not like, you know, it was 30 or 40 years ago where everybody, unless you're a historian, unless you know what the Fed used to do, people forget there was a day when they never used to make announcements as to what they were doing. You could assume the Fed was shifting their interest rate targets because someone was selling the hell out of bonds, and guess what that did to yields? Just like buying bonds drives them lower, when someone's selling them, it sends them higher. That's how they actually operated. They didn't come out and say, we're raising our target to 2.5%. It just happened in the bond market. And so today, not only do they announce their targets, they say, oh, and by the way, if you want to front-run us, we're going to be buying $40 billion worth of mortgage-backed bonds or mortgage-backed securities for the, you know, as far as the eye can see, at least for the next 12 months and maybe longer. So they're not just a participant. They are a public participant engaging in active jawboning, letting everybody know, here's exactly what we're going to do. And the reason for that is they're trying to push markets. They're trying to push interest rates. They're trying to push risk appetites in a certain direction. In order, I think their thinking is, here's how we'll stimulate the economy. Here's how we'll get people psychologically more comfortable with assuming more credit, spending more money, making more investments. We could criticize that as whether or not it's a well-founded policy, but as an asset manager, I have to look and say, okay, what does this mean for fixed income? What does this mean for commodities? What does this mean for the economy? What does this mean for earnings? And what does this mean for equities?
Absolutely. You know, my grandfather served on the New York Federal Reserve Board under Volcker for a period of time. And back then, one of their policy tools was surprise. But that Fed doesn't exist anymore. They've taken that tool out of the box in favor of policy direction. So what's the situation right now? The Fed has clearly said we're asset price targeting here. We want to, you know, all sorts of things we'd like to have happen. The wealth effect. We'd like to repair balance sheets. A lot of good things they want to have happen. That's the situation. So do you see that changing at any point in time? Or have you sort of dialed back the element of surprise to near zero and just counted on the idea that you were going to get plenty of advance warning from the Fed when they do decide to start to tack in a different direction?
Yeah, I think surprise hasn't been in their playbook for a while, and it's a shame because it certainly could be effective. Although I do think a lot of people were surprised at the size and scope of QE3 this time. As I mentioned in that piece, Situational Awareness, there's been this horrific blind spot for the Fed. You know, they should be a known unknown, as Rumsfeld used to say, and yet people continue to be surprised. They telegraph what they say very clearly. They're working with John Hilsengrath of the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. That's the worst-kept secret in the world, that when he writes something, it's because Ben whispers in his ear, here's what's going on. You know, when you see a week before Jackson Hole, hey, we're likely to come out with some form of QE, people were still denying it up to the last minute. Mm-hmm. Oh, they can't do it in an election year. Oh, their balance sheet is already too big. Hey, these guys have a history. Here's the track record. They say something in the Hilsengrath. He publishes it in the Wall Street Journal. And then it happens 2 weeks later. And yet people continue to be surprised by it. By the way, I don't want people to misunderstand this. It's not that people shouldn't be criticizing the Fed. It's not that people shouldn't be, you know, actively and vocally debating public policy and monetary policy. But if you're doing that instead of managing your assets, if you're doing that instead of paying attention to how you should be positioning your portfolio, you're going to be in trouble as an asset manager.
Well, you know, I have talked to a lot of people who are professional money managers, many running some pretty big funds, and there is a level of paralysis out there, particularly for people who had methods and tools and processes that seemed to work for a long time that no longer work. Asset correlations, you know, spiking, and a variety of things that used to be tried and true, not really working as well anymore. Alpha shrinking. What's your view on this? Do you think the markets have really fundamentally changed, and some of this is paralyzed people who don't know how to operate in this environment, or is there something deeper going on?
I think the markets are the same as they've ever been. They're driven by human nature. They're driven by psychology of fear and greed. Sometimes the fear is missing out on the rally. Sometimes the fear is, uh-oh, things are going lower. What what has changed the game so dramatically post-2008 crisis is the footprint of the Federal Reserve and what they're doing. And so, look, I've said this a number of times. If the Fed wasn't involved in this market, I would be looking at decelerating macroeconomics. I would look at earnings peaking and reversing. I would look at a number of factors that would have me radically reduce my equity exposure. You know, we run an asset allocation model that uses a 60-40 benchmark, 60% equities, 40% fixed income. We came into the year 80-20, way overweighted equities.
Mm-hmm.
And as the market has rallied, each time we rebalance, we take a little bit off the table, but we've also made a conscious decision to just go to equal weight as opposed to overweight. Now, if this was a normal situation, I would probably be 40-60. I'd probably be 40% equities. But it's really, really challenging to say, despite the fire hose of liquidity, despite the really low fixed income rates, despite cash being trash, I want to still sell stocks. In light of what's going on, I just can't do it. You know, by making bond yields so low, you drive money out of bonds into equities, and by providing so much liquidity to banks, history has shown us that when that happens, it seems to find its way into equity markets. I always like to remind people, in October 1999, when the Fed was so concerned about Y2K, which turned out to be misplaced fear, they just did a $50 billion one-off. And from that point till 6 months forward, the NASDAQ, which had been screaming higher for 10 years, doubled over the next 6 months. I tell people October 99 to March 2000, the NASDAQ doubled. No one believes me. They have to go look it up. You know, we had 2490 or something like that in October, and the Fed announces this $50 billion liquidity issuance in order to make sure that there are no fears that there's a run on the bank, that ATMs run out of money. There's plenty of cash in the banks for January 1st, and they started that 3 months earlier. And the markets, which were in full-throat bull mode, just doubled. So when you look at that historically, when you look at when the Fed says we're going to increase liquidity, we're going to put a lot of cash in the system as a I call it a lubricant. I don't know what they call it, but the impact is that risk assets go higher, and that's pretty much stocks, bonds, and as we've seen as the dollar has weakened, commodities as well. Look at what happened under Greenspan, and once Bernanke took over, from 01 to 07, the dollar lost 41% of its value. And I have no doubt that was driven by Fed policy.
Well, now, when we look at the $50 billion, that injection back in 1999, how quaint.
For sure.
Yeah, so when
although
we look...
it's quaint today, but relative to Fed interventions at that time, it was a pretty hefty chunk of change. I mean, it's today you look at it and it's a rounding error, but back then it was like, wow, this is really pretty substantial.
Yeah, it had that surprise element. It was maybe 10x the size of their normal permanent market operation. It was pretty big, as I saw it. It was, yeah, it caught me up by surprise back then as well. So here we are. We've got $40 billion a month now pouring in indefinitely. We've got the Fed saying that as necessary, they might do other asset purchases, leaving a little vagueness to this potential trajectory. And you think that they're going to continue to step in, and what is it that they're really aiming for here? Can we take them at face value and say they're focusing on employment in the context of price stability, or are they really targeting asset prices here?
You know, they believe in the wealth effect, and years ago, before the crisis, I recall writing something called Tales of the Wealth Effect have been greatly exaggerated. The concept behind the wealth effect is this. When we look at the history of stock markets, when prices rise, people have a tendency, or so goes the narrative, to feel better, and then thus they go out and spend more money, hire more people, make more investments, and you have this virtuous cycle. There's a pretty significant flaw in that argument. There's actually a few, but let me just give you the two biggest flaws. The first is just your classic logical reasoning, causation and correlation error. when stocks are going up, you have to look at, is that causing the spending to take place, or is there an underlying factor mm-hmm. affecting both of those? And historically, when you look at long bull markets, when you look at the history of the stock market, when you have a substantial rally in equities, it tends to be because you're having this broader secular expansion in the macro economy, in employment, in wages. And so it's not a surprise that people spend more. But it's the same factors that drive the spending that drive the that are also driving the increase in stock market. It's expansion and more hiring and more spending and greater profits. Oh, guess what? In that environment, stock prices go up and people spend more. But the stock prices aren't causing them to spend more. It's all the underlying factors that are affecting A are also affecting B. So rather than assume a causation relationship, it's really a correlation. The same things driving the stock market is driving spending, not stock market is driving spending. By the way, people make that mistake all the time when they look at elections and the Dow. You know, is the Dow good for the incumbent, bad for the incumbent? It's like, no, when the Dow is going higher, it tends to be good for the incumbent. When the Dow is going lower, it tends to be bad for the incumbent because of the underlying forces. So that's that wealth effect is the primary, seems to be, if you look at, read some of the speeches and listen to what Bernanke has said, that seems to be one of the primary focuses of the Fed. The problem with that is the numbers are vastly disproportionate to who owns equities. The average family has a $25,000 or $30,000 portfolio. The average 401k, which is typically a higher income person, is a $60,000 portfolio. And the numbers, you know, it's something like 50% is owned by the top 1%, 80% is owned by the top, or 75% is owned by the top 10%. And those are my client bases, and I can tell you they spend money. They don't care what the economy is doing other than, you know, full-blown Armageddon. The Fed isn't going to stimulate them to spend money. They spend money regardless of what's going on. And where the marginal spender, the marginal retail player, is somebody who really doesn't care much about what stock markets do. You know, if you're making $75,000 a year and you have a mortgage and kids going to college and a two-income family, the Fed moving interest rates up or down isn't going to make a difference. You're not going to say, all right, I'm going to start a business and buy a car and buy a house because rates are 3% lower. It's you're paying your bills, you're this and that. What's much more likely to have an impact on your spending habits are both people working? Is the person who's out of work getting a job? Is the person who's working getting a raise? Those are the factors that really impact. Is credit available? That impacts spending, not, gee, are we going to take rates? You know, we just got a proposal from our bank to lower our 30-year mortgage to 3.6%. I mean, that's insane, a fixed, no-point, 3.6% mortgage. And if you do a 15-year mortgage, it's 2.75%. These are just unfathomable numbers, and it means that if you qualify for a mortgage, you actually have about 15% more buying power than you would have 2 years ago. And yet still, housing is just bumping along the bottom.
I think that point you made before is about the concentration of wealth, which has certainly been a feature. It's been much discussed and well dissected from the data standpoint. That certainly has to be a drag on the wealth effect because, as you note, people who are above a certain income level, their spending habits are not really going to be all that impacted by whether their portfolio is gyrating up or down a few points.
That's exactly right. I mean, and here's the thing that I think people forget. When you go through these long periods of time, if someone decides to take some cash and say, all right, I'm getting no money out of the 10-year bond yielding 1.6%, let me move 10% of my portfolio to equities, that's a paper transaction. That's not like building a factory, constructing mm-hmm. a building. It has almost no impact other than driving, you know, helping to drive stock prices higher. So I think the underlying belief that, hey, if we can only get equity prices higher, people will go out and spend. Now, keep in mind, the opposite, however, may be true. The opposite is, when everything is in free fall, when markets are crashing, we have a tendency as human beings to be deer in the headlight, and everybody kind of freezes. And you hear a lot during 08, 09, you used to hear, you know, I want to go do this. I want to buy this house, buy this car, buy whatever. I'm going to wait a little bit and just see how things shake out. So, well, why? You own your own business. You know what your cash flow looks like. I know you have money in the bank. You're not buying $1 billion. You know, you're not buying a Viron. You're going out and getting a car 1 month to another. Do you really think you can't make the $700 a month payment, depending on the economy? But that's human nature. You know, people have a tendency to see the backdrop. And I think people tend to overreact to the negative much more than they positively react to the positive.
Well, you know what's making me nervous right now is not that the Fed is being so interventionist, but that their interventions, all the trillions of them, including here I have to toss in the Bank of Japan as well, the ECB, and the UK. So
it's global and it's well coordinated.
It is. And what's worrying me is that I actually expected more bang for the buck. I was expecting a greater sort of market response and better yet, an economic response, and it's not there. So my concern is that the forces of deleveraging, I'm worried about being like Japan, like that this could just be a fairly persistent.
Go on forever.
Yeah, it could go on forever, which means growth is going to be really subpar. And if it slips into recession, all of a sudden we have banks, big central banks holding onto a lot of very expensive assets in a poor environment. Do you have any concerns that we're not seeing the traction we should have seen? Do you have any worries there?
Yes and no. You know, the yes is they've thrown an awful lot of firepower and have not gotten a lot of bang for the buck. So that's the initial concern. The no part, I'll give you a two-parter on that. The first is, you know, history shows us that fiscal policy has a much bigger impact on the broader economy than monetary policy has. Monetary policy has a tendency to affect finance and to affect things that are financed or purchased with credit or what have you. So it can impact auto sales and it can impact home sales to some degree, and it can change those sorts of prices. But it's going to have a modest impact on employment, and it's going to have a modest impact on GDP compared to what I think could be accomplished or not through fiscal policy. The reason I think we're not sliding into a full-on Japan, first, unlike Japan, we had the FDIC put a number of banks into bankruptcy. So when you look at Washington Mutual or Wachovia or go down the list, you know, hundreds of lenders went belly up, that's the FDIC's role. They're supposed to, A, guarantee the deposits of people up to whatever it is now, X dollars per account, and B, be a regulator of banks and say this bank is insolvent or this bank is not handling the depositors correctly, and close them down. And the FDIC was pretty effective. In fact, if the FDIC would have been in charge instead of Treasury and the White House and the Fed, we would have been better off because all these banks, and that includes Bank of America and Citigroup, would have been put into a reorganization and come out with their debt wiped out, their senior management fired, all of their equity zeroed out, and the bondholders basically own what's left. So instead of bondholders being bailed out and getting 100 cents on the dollar for making loans to insolvent companies, they would have gotten, pick a number, 20 cents, 27 cents, somewhere in that range. 15 to 35 is probably a broad enough range to include what they would have been left with after they discharged all their bad loans, and we'd be much healthier. It would have been more painful. Hey, maybe we would have been looking at Dow 5000, I don't know. But you would have had a much quicker recovery because you're still not saddled with all this debt. And not only that, don't kid ourselves, when we look at Fed policy, it's very much geared at protecting banks who still carry a lot of bad loans, who are still servicing a lot of mortgages that are underwater. And if we had a normal or a normalized Federal Reserve policy with rates higher, that means real estate might be another 15 or 20% lower. And that would have a significant impact on the lenders and the banks who underwrote those mortgages. So not only did the bailouts turn out to be ill-advised, and when we look at countries that didn't do bailouts, places like Sweden or Greenland, or Iceland, I'm sorry, not Greenland, Iceland, mm-hmm. Admittedly much smaller countries than the United States, they ripped the Band-Aid off. They put the banks into a sort of prepackaged bankruptcy. What we did with GM, we should have done for Citi and Bank of America. And while it's more painful at first, the healing process is much quicker. Instead, we're in this 10-year convalescence, and here it is, 2012. It's 5 years, 4 years after Lehman dropped. So we're not even halfway through this process, and in order to allow the banks to rehabilitate their balance sheets. It's really a backwards way to do this. It's saving the banks but letting the banking system falter. That's what the Japanese did. What the Swedish did was something completely. In the early 90s, when they had their banking crisis, their answer was, the hell with the banks, save the banking system. And by putting all these banks into bankruptcy, you end up with a much healthier, much more competitive banking sector. So, you know, again, not to just wax on the policy, you know, my approach, my investing approach to this has been to steer clear from any of the banks with mortgage exposure, any of the banks that have a liability that can potentially come back to bite them. In the finance sector, for example, we don't want to have zero exposure, but we own firms like Visa, which doesn't take credit risk. They give that to the banks. You know, when you get a credit card, it's through Chase or Wells Fargo or Citi or whoever your bank is, and they're the ones with the risk if you decide not to pay your credit card. Visa is really just the toll keeper. So it's more than, and I keep coming back to this from our original conversation where sea monsters live, it's more than just being the armchair critic. You have to say, and the impact of this from an investment perspective is, I want to own this and I don't want to own that for all the above reasons. And all of these things that we're talking about, where people seem to falter is taking it to the next step and saying, well, what does this mean from a risk versus reward perspective?
Well, very interesting. I love that description. And a while ago, you mentioned that there are actually a number of things that get impacted by QE. One of them is commodities. I'm a little confused by world oil prices. I checked Brent, right? So we're at 114 yesterday. What do you make of these high oil prices right now in terms of your macro analysis and how it impacts equities, growth, things like that, but most importantly, maybe the rescue and recovery operations that are currently underway? I note that in history, I can't find a single example of an economic recovery with oil at inflation-adjusted $100 or more a barrel.
Well, you have a couple of cross-currents working at each other with oil. First, obviously, every time there's a issue in the Middle East, there's a real significant concern about prices and Straits of Hormuz being problematic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Iraq is still slowly coming online. We're still way behind where we should be with that. So on the one hand, you have the Fed printing money, the Fed, I don't want to say debasing the dollar, but the Fed creating future inflation expectations and turmoil in the Middle East. Those are both positive forces for prices. That's going to drive prices higher. On the flip side, you have a slowing global economy. We saw it recently with the FedEx data. It's pretty clear. Mm-hmm. They're a leading indicator. The transports in general look awful. You have Europe. Look, half of Europe is, if it's not on the edge of a recession, it's already slipping into a recession.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, Spain and Greece are in deep recessions. Ireland in a modest recession. Germany is near recession. China, we know, has slowed down dramatically, as have a number of other Pacific Rim countries. And the nicest thing we could say about the U.S. economy is it continues to muddle along just above stall speed. You know, there's that zone. You really can't exist in the 0 to 1.5% GDP for too long. It's like a plane running on four engines. And when you're at 1.5% or 1%, it's like you're flying on an engine or two. You could go a little while, but it's really eventually going to stall. You can't operate it at that speed. You're going too slowly. So you need to be over 2% consistently. Otherwise, and everybody seems to fear a recession like it's the end of the universe, otherwise you go into a normal recession, which isn't the end of the world. During a recession, misallocated capital gets reallocated more appropriately. Businesses that are on the verge fail. Someone once described recessions and market crashes as events that take place in order to return money to its rightful owners, meaning money leaves the speculators and heads back to real investors. And yet, so much of the policy we've seen from the Fed and from the government has been, what can we do to avoid this next bailout, to avoid this next recession? Sometimes you just have to let the recessions happen, which again brings me back to, if this was a normal situation, I'd be battening down the hatches and waiting for the storm to come forward. Instead, you know, we're looking at a Fed with a fire hose and wondering, you know, every time there's a 10 to 20% correction in the equity market, they throw more cash at the system in order to generate some improvement. If I think the fear is if they let the equity market fall 25-30%, it has that negative impact. Whether or not that's an intelligent decision or not is a different story, but the pattern has been set, and from as an investor, when that happens, you can pretty much expect the next, you know, hit of heroin from them.
Well, as speaking of those countervailing forces, then we've got the Fed with a fire hose on one hand, and I note that they did fund an awful lot of the fiscal deficit last year, if you want to look at it that way. And we have this thing called the fiscal cliff coming up, so-called. What's your view on that particular event or potential non-event? Are you positioning for that at all? Does it concern you?
You know, I look at it, there's a couple of factors that sort of make it, I think people make more of a deal about it than they should. Gun to a head, the Congress ultimately does what it has to do, number one. Number two, there's a legal argument, and I say this as a recovering attorney, there's a legal argument to be made that, hey, you know, the Congress in the Constitution has the power of the purse. And when Congress authorizes spending, they don't have to a second time say, and we really mean it, hey, this money has already been authorized. That's it. You have Congress authorizing the money. If somewhere else along the lines they said up to this amount, well, too bad. You've already authorized that money. I don't know if anybody wants to go to the Supreme Court and make that argument, but stop and think about it. Since the constitutional authority for spending is with Congress, how can they not spend money that Congress has said, here's how much we're spending and here's how much we're taxing? That's kind of been done. That's a little out in the weeds for a lot of people. The third thing is, hey, so what if they hit the fiscal cliff? What that'll mean is, A, we'll see deep cuts in the military, not the worst thing in the world. We have a bigger military than the next 25 countries combined. P.S., 22 of them are allies. Number two, we'll see deep cuts in Social Security. And number three, we'll see deep cuts in Medicaid. And then lastly, you'll see the Bush tax cuts expire, and we'll go back to the tax levels of the 1990s, which wasn't a terrible time. So if the sequestration takes place, all those cuts are likely to lead to a pretty significant recession. But as we just said before, that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. In fact, in many ways, it's got a healthy cleansing effect. Now, if I think that's going to happen, if we see signs that's going to happen, then I'm going to want to hedge my equity positions. I'm going to want to increase my fixed income positions. I'm going to want to jettison any commodities I own, because that severe, or I should really call it a significant recession, you can see a 30 to 40% correction in equities. You could see a significant rally in bonds from already pricey levels. And it means that demand for a lot of commodities is going to fall off the cliff, at least for, you know, 6 months, and then everybody will figure it out and we'll move forward. But I'm not looking at that as the worst thing in the world. That's a potentially healthy recession. You know, a lot of people forget a lot of the troubles that we're in trace back to Greenspan's refusal to allow a normal recession to take place in 2001 and 2002 following the dot-com crash. Had we had a healthy collapse, had we had a economic equivalent to the dot-com crash, we very likely wouldn't find ourselves in the situation we're in today. Instead, He took rates down to what was then the unprecedented level of under 2% for 3 years, and actually at 1% for a year. At the time, that just simply had never happened. And post-crash, well, here we are at zero, but that wasn't a full-blown financial crisis. That was just a run-of-the-mill equity bubble that popped. Had he allowed that to run its course, I think we'd all be much better off today.
Well, there's a sense I have, and I think others share this as well, that we had these mini crises. So when I look back at, say, long-term capital management in 98, that's just a blip compared to some of the crises, you know, we've got going on now. So there's a sense that the amplitude and frequency are sort of building. And maybe this is a function of just living in a more globalized economy, but maybe it's because we forestalled wanting to take the pain and we've sort of been saving it up. And if you're an average investor right now, you're just somebody, you know, you've got a job, you can't spend all your day looking at money, you care very much that it doesn't go away, you're worried about things like the custodial risk that Peregrine Financial and MF Global introduced to the equation, you're worried about maybe the things you have been reading about the NYSE recently, where trading information is asymmetrical to preferred clients, on and on and on. There's enough chattering noise in the sphere out there to erode that confidence. And you don't have time to maybe manage your money on a minute-by-minute basis. What would you do in that circumstance? What advice do you give people?
Well, I give a couple of different speeches, and one of them is called Stop Paying Me So Much. And essentially, I tell people, you know, the average investor should be dollar-cost averaging into a broad set of indexes and not trying to time the market and not trying to pick stocks and not trying to outguess everybody else. You don't have the time. You don't have the expertise. Oh, and P.S., the way you're wired, you're going to tend to buy too much at the top and panic and sell at the bottom. So I always, oh, and by the way, you're paying people way too much for advice. If you have a big account, if you have a complicated tax situation, if you are concerned about generational wealth transfer and, you know, blah, 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 well, then it's okay. It's worth it to pay somebody. But we see accounts all the time and say to people, you're paying way too much for advice. This is a really simple portfolio. You have pretty basic needs. And just do this, this, and this, and you shouldn't really be paying anybody a whole lot of anything for that. That's the basic advice. The biggest problem with that advice is, you know, the math is unequivocal. The academic papers on it are just conclusive. There's no real debate about this. The problem is execution. Most people don't have the discipline to follow it, which means when everything looks terrible and crappy, they'll override the automatic purchase when things were you know, really cheap. Look at 2009 and look at the amount of inflows into equities. It was de minimis. And if you're really doing that sort of dollar cost averaging, you should be buying back when the S&P was in the high 600s and the Dow was in the 6,000s and yet even 7,000s, 8,000s, and yet most people don't do that. And when everybody's chatting about stocks, when things are at, you know, 1,500 on the S&P, 1,600, and it's a topic of conversation, the natural inclination is to say, hey, I want to get involved in this and to pay up. You know, equities are the only thing in the world that we're much more comfortable paying more for than paying less for. And mm-hmm. It's the way we're wired.
You know, just this morning, I think I saw every major house have some sort of an article about gold in this post-QE eternity sort of environment. What's your take on gold here?
Well, we first recommended gold back in, based on Greenspan's behavior, back in, it's not quite a decade ago, but it's almost a decade ago. And it was pretty clear, hey, here's what's going on, and here's inflation, and here's what's happening to the dollar. And I could look at those inputs and say, given those inputs, we're going to see gold prices go up. Now we're in a different environment. We've had the recession. We've had the crash. I'm less convinced that I have any sort of insight as to guessing where gold is going to be. You know, with equities, I could look at discounted cash flow and earnings and dividends. With fixed income, I could look at what's the credit rating, is it AAA, is it B, is it this, what's the interest rate, what's the yield to maturity, and so there's some basis of pricing those assets. With gold, essentially, I'm now stuck with, will someone want to pay more for it than I paid for it? And that becomes a bit of a challenge, especially you know, when you're coming up on $2,000, this has historically been a place where it's tough to get through, absent some major catastrophic event. So we own a little bit of gold. We have it as a little bit of a hedge. The more I study gold prices, the more I think there's a minimal correlation with inflation and a much greater correlation with the value of the dollar, which is how it's priced, and the behavior of consumers in countries like India and China, who are the big marginal buyers of gold. And anecdotally, I can tell you, when prices get up to $1,800, $1,900, $2,000, those consumers tend to be sellers, and when they get down $1,600, $1,500, $1,400, those consumers tend to be buyers. It's something that I just don't have a whole lot of insight into. The one thing I could say about gold, at least when I look at oil, I could look at coal and I could look at natural gas and say, hey, what are these costs per BTU and how relevant is it and how expensive is it to ship it? And, you know, you can easily ship oil and you can easily ship coal, and it's a little harder to ship natural gas other than compressing it and liquefying it. So there's some frame of reference to looking at the prices. With copper and aluminum and other industrial metals, you can look at demand and the overall economy. With gold, I can't look at any of those things. So that's a long, rambling way of me saying I have no idea where gold is going to go. But I do own a little bit of it.
That's fair enough. I like gold as well because there's a small embedded option value in it, which is that if we do have a big international currency crisis at some point, the idea that we might default to something that we know works, which would be a gold standard, whether that's, you know, modified, fractional, or full basis, doesn't matter. If that happens, I see very much higher gold prices. So I like the option value that it's got contained in it. And like all good options, it's way out of the money right now, but it'll have an excellent payout if it does come to pass. It's a long shot, but it's the kind of thing I like to have a little of in my portfolio on that basis alone.
There's some pretty wild forecasts. I mean, look, 2,000, 2,200, that's, you know, spitting distance. That's not a big deal. But I'm always surprised when I see people say, here's how we figure gold goes to 5,000, or here's how gold could reach $12,000 an ounce. I'm a little skeptical of those. I've found the Armageddon scenarios. It's always been a bad bet for two reasons. First, it hasn't happened, and second, if you win, how are you going to collect? So, I haven't really been keen on the end of the world scenarios and the here's what we're going to do because everything is going to hell, and so sell everything, buy bottled water and canned food, and buy gold. But I love. By the way, I love the group. Buy physical gold. You don't even want to own, you know, an interest in gold. You want to physically have the gold in your locked in a safe that's embedded in the concrete in your basement. You know, I'm not looking to fight off a zombie apocalypse if that's the case. To me, having a little bit of gold in portfolio makes sense. I think it's a good potential hedge against other forms of economic disruption, but I have no idea where the price is going to be.
I understand that. I do advocate physical gold, if only because it's a way of controlling counterparty risk if you can't assess
Absolutely. Where
the counterparty risk really is. You know that old saying, if you're at a card table and you don't know who the sucker is, it's
yep.
you?
That's right.
I can't read J.P. Morgan's 10-Q and make any sense of it. I honestly don't know what the risk there is. And I'm not saying because of that I assume it's very high. I'm telling you I don't understand their derivative positions or how they're hedged. And I lost confidence with their little whale shenanigans, saying maybe they didn't understand hedging as a verb either. So at any rate, that's just, you know, one reason I get into that. So, hey, as we come up on the end of our time, you have a really interesting conference coming up. I'd love to hear about.
Oh, sure. So our conference, we do a big picture conference every year. And the whole goal of this is, you know, some of the conferences out there are, here's this guy to tell you what stocks to buy, and here's somebody who's going to tell you what to short. And I've never been a fan of those sort of things. What you know, we prefer is teaching people a fish as opposed to giving them a fish. And so what we've managed to put together is just a killer lineup of people coming to speak, and it's just, I'll give you a quick rundown. Neil Barofsky was the Special Investigator mm-hmm. General of the TARP. He's the first speaker, and he's going to describe the sort of stuff that happens in Washington, D.C. If you think you know what a disaster Washington, D.C. is, after spending time with Neil, I discovered it's worse than anything I imagined. Huh. David Rosenberg, who used to be Merrill Lynch's chief economist, has been dead on gold, dead on commodities, dead on fixed income for the past few years, and has a really good macroeconomic perspective, will be speaking. Dylan Grice, very early in recognizing Europe as a big risk area. He's an economist at Société Générale. He'll be speaking. Jim Bianco, really well-regarded institutional equity and market analyst. Some great, great calls over the past few years. Jim is the guy who pretty much turned me on to, here's what the impact of QE is going to be, way back in August 2010 when people were looking at this market and saying, hey, this is falling apart. He recognized really early QE was going to be the deciding factor. Michael Belkin used to be with Salomon Brothers. Now he's out in Washington State, puts out the Belkin Report. His clients are just giant hedge funds and mutual funds. Another guy that on the institutional side, really super well regarded. You may have seen the book, What Works on Wall Street. You know, that's sort of the quant Bible. James O'Shaughnessy wrote that decades ago, and I think it's in its eighth printing now. He'll be speaking, super interesting guy. Richard Yamarone of Bloomberg is an economist there. Bill Gerton runs Gerton Fixed Income, just a really savvy muni bond shop, has just done really, really well. When you have people like Meredith Whitney screaming the sky is falling, he goes through the rubble and picks out the winners and losers. They have a great track record. People don't know him because it's a relatively modest-sized muni shop out in California, but they're great. Scott Patterson's a Wall Street Journal reporter, wrote two killer books. One is called The Quants, and the other is called Dark Pools. They're both really good. He's doing a panel with Sal Arnuch, who mm-hmm. is from Themis Trading, is a high-frequency trading critic, and their book is Broken Markets. Actually, the person leading that panel is Josh Brown, who's works with me. He's a well-regarded blogger and has a huge following on Twitter. And then I, each year, use the conference to have a little fun and present something on behavioral economics and neurofinance. And, you know, I want people to understand, here's how flawed your thought process is. How are you going to make intelligent decisions about investing when you're really much more likely to panic about this or misread that or engage in selective perception with here or there. But it's October 10th. If you go to the Big Picture blog at ritholtz.com, you can find something for it. And I'm looking forward to it. It should be a whole lot of fun.
October 10th, and where is that going to be held?
It's in New York City. It'll be at the TIA CREF Conference Center, which is right in Midtown. And we've really put together a great list of people this year. I'm very jazzed about it.
Oh, you sound jazz. It really sounds incredible. That's October 10th, and it's in New York. And we've been talking with Barry Ritholtz of The Big Picture and author of Bailout Nation. You should check out the website first and read the book second, or reverse the order, however you get there. You really want to follow this guy. Thank you so much, Barry.
Well, thanks, Chris. This has been fun.